I really liked Chicago's early stuff that didn't involve Pizzaterra at all. Like, it was just like Robert Lamb just like doing like jazzy shit. Like, that'd be great.
Well, I mean, honestly, with Chicago, I used to hate Chicago. And now I think they're actually like their hits are in. I like 25. What annoys me about 25 or 6-4 is I thought it was 25/or 6-4, like either some kind of fight or a competition or something. But it's actually 25 or 26 until 4 p.m., which I think is very less interesting. And speaking of big fours, this is Punk News Podcast episode 402, where we're going to be talking about Chicago. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. We're going to be talking about Chicago all day today. Every album from Chicago won the Chicago 34. Sean, we're here with Stanford Sean. Stanford Sean, Chicago 13 or Chicago 19? Which do you think is the better of the Chicago albums? Because both albums are divisive among the Chicago fan community.
I honestly haven't listened to much Chicago, to be honest.
Sean, oh, man. John, one of the first records that I ever owned was a copy of Chicago Transit Authority that I like dug out of a bin at a flea market.
The first one?
I think the first one.
Are there any hits on that one? I thought all the hits were on like Chicago 5 or something.
It's been a while. I feel like it was the first one, but I mean, it was a very contentious thing for me because being a kid that grew up in the, you know, who was born in the early 80s, that would have meant my mom was at like peak Pizzaterra solo career listening saturation, so I hated that shit. Like, I had like it's
pretty bad.
But before I had any opinion on music, I realized a few things, and the one was that I really hated the Eagles, like pre it being cool to hate the Eagles, like pre Lebowski. I really hated the Eagles, and I really hated Pizzaterra. And I think both of those things come from like songs that were like on the radio in my mom's van when I was a kid.
Eagles are still, I mean, I actually kind of like Chicago's greatest hits. Eagles are just so bad. Adam, it's interesting when you say Pizzaterra, it sounds like you're saying Pizza Terrace, which is a lot more interesting to me than Pizzaterra.
Oh, I would love some Pizza Terrace.
Anyway, speaking of Pizza Terrace, we actually got a pretty jam-packed episode today. You can always reach us, that's Adam White, of course, I'm John Gentile. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We did have a lot of interesting letters this week. We got a letter from former President, President Obama. We got a letter from Mike Tyson. We got a letter from David Lee Roth. And we even got a letter from Judge Judy. And I was going to read them, but before the episode, Stanford Sean said he really wanted to talk about record collecting. So we're not going to read these letters this week. And actually, we won't read them next week because they were sent through Outlook. And they'll be deleted by the time we do next week's episode. So, you know, if you want to hear from Judge Judy, you can blame Stanford Sean. But we won't. But we're going to talk about whatever record Sean got. So, Sean, I'm sure what record you got is more important than what former president or actually, he's technically always President Obama. What the president has to say in these dire times. But tell us, Sean. What 311 or No Doubt CD did you get for $2.99 at the farmer's market?
I think according to the itinerary, we're probably going to be talking about this later, but I do have a show coming up that I've been trying to advertise. So I've been going around the city and putting up posters and stuff in locations where people are who would be of interest would be likely to see it. So I've been going to like a lot of record stores without the intention.
That's the key. Sean, you've thrown shows before. You don't need my, you've probably thrown more shows than I have.
Yeah, but not one where I've actually like physically advertised. I've only done things where I've advertised online, but this is,
Listeners, Stanford Sean, and we'll get into this. Stanford Sean is 18. He's already thrown dozens of shows. Maybe dozens, Sean.
I'd say probably two.
He's thrown two shows. And listen, he's got an 18-year drop on me, that's for sure. He's 18, and he's throwing a festival, and we're going to talk about this later. But the point is, if you're throwing a show, I have found that putting up flyers at record gigs, I mean record stores, is very effective, although I actually don't know how effective it is, but it seems effective. But also handing out flyers at punk shows of your target audience actually does kind of make a difference, I think. Yeah. Go ahead, Sean. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, but yeah, definitely. And this is kind of a first experience for me. So I was going into all these record stores without the intention of necessarily buying them, but that buying anything. But then inevitably, like, I'd stick around and I'd find something that I liked and would go ahead and get it, especially because, like some of the things, like, for example, I found like a copy of like Milo Goes to College and We Cool, which are like two records that for whatever reason, like, they are never stocked, but like I've wanted them for a while. But the really interesting one that I actually wanted to talk about, the one that kind of incited me to ask if we could do record collecting, was one from probably the shop that's, well, the record shop that's like most local to me, which is a shop called Hip Cat Records. And I went in there. It's a really small shop. Like, you know, it's kind of like an outlet. It's not huge. It's, pretty small shop. And I was browsing around for a little bit because I didn't have much time. I was in a bit of a hurry, but I had a bit of time to browse around and noticed that they had a Joan of Arc section, which I was interested in because it's a pretty small, as I said, small record store. And, you know, they don't have too many different sections. So I thought it was interesting that they would have a section devoted to Joan of Arc. So I mentioned it to the cashier. And he was talking about how, like, oh yeah, Tim Kinsella, like, used to come in here all the time. Like, this was like the record store that they would always come into. And then he went off like on another one of his tangents about Pink Floyd, because he's always just kind of roping Pink Floyd into every single conversation. but anyways,
I like that Sean can identify that even at the tender age of 18. How astute, Sean. How astute.
Anyways, I kept steering him back into this conversation because I thought it was very interesting that, like, you know, this was like the record shop that Tim Kinsella would always come into, like, and he mentioned, like, you know, they would always come in with friends and stuff. And he mentioned that there was a 10-inch from a band that was like friends with those guys, who was friends with like the Kinsellas and all of that. And he just still had a 10-inch that was there that had been in the bin since 1997, since before I was born. And it had just been in that record shop, never sold. And out of morbid curiosity, like, I mean, it was $6, and I bought it. And it's a band called V Reverse. It's actually a really cool record. I mean, not like anything revolutionary, but kind of like hardcore with a bit of like a post-hardcore edge. I guess kind of like more hardcore punk-oriented early Hot Water Music type stuff. It's a really cool record and kind of like a hidden gem of the Chicago scene. And I just thought it was also really cool that, you know, these guys were friends with the Kinsellas and then they went off and they did their big things. And, these guys kind of got, pushed into obscurity, which I thought was cool. And then, one more record that I wanted to mention that has less of a cool story of me coming across it, but I think is just a very cool record that, came in the past week, is a band that I've talked about a lot on this show that I very much love. Telethon's The Grand Spontanean was just pressed to vinyl. And it's a double album. Like, it's got the gatefold and everything. But I think probably the coolest part about it is, and it's a concept record, so I'm going to be spoiling it a bit. So if you haven't heard it, maybe hit the 15-second skip button a couple of times. There is at the end of the album kind of a choose your own adventure style ending. So there's two songs that can end the album. So they had to do.
Oh, is it a lock groove or something?
What? No. It's they include an extra 7-inch with both of the possibilities. So.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That
so
is
the album
cool.
is divided into five different like sections, and each section actually happened to fit on one side. I mean, each of the first four fit on one side, and then the fifth one is on the 7-inch. So. It's a pretty cool concept and sounds great. If you are into these guys, I highly recommend picking this package up. It's a really, really cool package overall. And if you buy it from the band, you get like the playbill and, you know, a little pin and everything. So that's what I wanted to mention in the record collection.
That is cool. What I was going to say is, isn't one of the Punk News guys involved in that band?
Yeah, Alex. My link.
Alex.
Yeah,
Alex
he is the bassist. Okay, yeah. But right now he is not playing with them because he is touring with Holy Pinto over in Europe.
So. Fair enough. That's cool. Yeah. Sean, when you're putting up flyers, do you feel guilty into buying something? I always do when I go like putting up flyers in record stores. I walk in, and unless I know the record store really well, and even then I feel guilty. I feel like they're like looking at me. I feel as though I have to buy even like a $3 CD before I can ask to put something up. And I realize the clerks probably don't give a shit at all, but I always feel as though I'm being interrogated with their eyes when I walk in. Do you feel that way, or am I psycho?
I felt at least a bit obliged to like look around to at least like really? Consider some stuff, but yeah.
I would say it's even more ballsy to look around, not buy something, and put something up. Interesting.
Yeah.
Adam White, what's your stance?
I've never hung anything up in a record store or anywhere, so I'm not really sure what the protocol is there. But I feel that buying something, or at the very least making like a fairly significant amount of conversation with the person that's there, would only be the decent thing to do.
See, I think I disagree on that. I think you should buy something. First of all, if you buy like a $4 CD, is that enough? Is that enough of a purchase price to be able to put something up on the wall? I think it is.
I mean, I don't think there is any particular purchase price, because I walked in and that was the first thing I did. And then afterwards, I kind of stayed around out of courtesy and checked out stuff. And then I actually found things that I wanted to get anyways. And ended up going.
I think a big part of it depends, like, if you are a person that has been seen going to this store and being a participant in their community, like, you know, then it makes it easier for you to go have that conversation. If you're just some jackass that walks in off the street with a giant stack of flyers and a roll of tape, well, that's different.
See, my move is to buy like a $4 CD. I mean, honestly, pretty much every record store, there's something I want. And so I'll get like a $4 CD or a $3 record or more. And I'll be like, oh, is it cool if I put this flyer up like after I pay for it, to like kind of, I guess, force them to say yes. You know what I mean? But I don't know.
Well, I mean,
Adam, you're getting cool.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of happened to get into, like, for example, like, this is my first time going to Sugar Records. For whatever reason, I'd never been there. Really cool place in Chicago, and struck up a good conversation with the person there. But that was just kind of formed naturally out of kind of the conversation starter of, oh, I'm putting on this show. And then kind of wanting to talk about it and, you know, we got into a conversation about like some of his like favorite like 90s Chicago punk bands and stuff like that. Cool.
Adam White, you get anything cool lately?
God, I don't know. Do I have anything cool lately? I mean, I was, well, we talked on our last episode about how I'm now way less hesitant about just like buying tapes. Which I don't really have a working player for, as we've revealed. So I'm not exactly sure what they're here for, but they're starting to accumulate in my place. I was just today about to go and make a purchase of something that I think the world needs to know about. So I'm going to make mention of this. This is not a thing that I have purchased yet, if for no other reason than I just haven't got around to it, and I want to make mention of it because cool. There's not going to be too many of them. There's a there's like a garage psych artist out of Montreal called Paul Jacobs. I saw him play last year. It was totally wild. Like, if you want to think of him as like a slightly more druggy lo-fi version of Iggy Pop, maybe. And like, his band is wild, and he takes like these crazy noisy you know, walls of feedback and sound and like otherwise unlistenable garbage sounds, and he makes these amazing pop songs out of them. So Paul Jacobs rules. So anyways, he had an EP that he just put out called Story About Anything. And so Paul is he's an artist, and his medium is mostly like cartoonist stuff. So he draws like a lot of like sketches, and it's like his stuff is like super super simple and childlike, but it's like instantly recognizable. Like every time I've seen it on a show flyer or anything like that, like I know that Paul Jacobs drew that flyer. He has that kind of art that he sort of nailed down as being like his thing. So he puts out these tapes. He made 100 of them, and then he drew the cover for each of the 100 tapes. And then the amazing and practical wacky thing about it is, if you were to have acquired all 100 tapes, the covers to all of them make like a flipbook animation.
That's funny. That's so funny.
So like he went and he put them up for sale, and like he put a little YouTube video of the tapes up to kind of show you the animation working. And he's like, you know, grab one, grab two, grab all 100 if you want to see him move. And I'm like, this is amazing because like it is so gloriously impractical. Like no one ever is going to have more than one of these tapes. So the fact that each of them is a frame in an animation that no one's ever going to see move is just like I like things that are just done for whimsy. John, you're a whimsy guy, right? Like,
I'm very into whimsy, Adam.
Right? Like things that are just done to be strange and just to create something, even if it doesn't really make any sense. This is one of these things that just makes no sense. So yeah, the world should totally A, go listen to Paul Jacobs because he's great, but B, go buy one of these tapes so you can see the animation not move.
That's cool. That's cool.
What about you, Mr. John? Anything that tickles your fancy right now?
Yeah. Adam, like, you may remember this. You remember, I think it was about 2002 or so, the Beastie Boys put out a fairly landmark compilation that had a lot of their hits and had a lot of super obscure rarities. It was called The Sound of Science. You remember that?
Yes.
Do you remember the following, Adam? And you might not.
White cover, splash of colors, something like that.
White cover with the three Beastie Boys dressed as older gentlemen.
Sounds of Science. Yeah, what am I thinking? I'm thinking of the In Sound from Way Out's cover. Yeah, okay, Sounds of Science. Definitely. Got it.
And do you remember at that time, this was during the earlier years of the internet, you could actually go online and custom make your own Beastie Boys greatest hits, including ultra, ultra rare tracks, and the Beastie Boys or company would put it together for you and mail it to you. Do you remember that?
I do not, but that is cool.
It was real cool. At the time, though, I was probably 19 or 18 or maybe even 17, whenever that came out, and I did not do that because at the time it was like $25. When you're 17, $25 is a lot of money, you know, and I didn't. And ever since then, I've regretted not doing it because there are ultra, ultra, ultra rare tracks on. Well, actually, the compilation, I think, had basically 30 songs on it, and you could pick whatever 30 songs you wanted out of a pool of like 500. The kicker being about 20 of the 500 were super, super rare that you literally could not get anywhere else, or you could get on like the Australian lathe cut of Aglioe Olio. There's only like 25 of them, something like that, like Light My Fire or Sober Violence or like just super obscure tracks that like you've never even heard of by the Beastie Boys.
So do you know if all 500 of these songs were picked by some of the people who participated in this?
Well, most of the songs were just the albums, right?
Yeah.
And then Beastie Boys have a lot of tracks. Like, there's only, what, 7 Beastie Boy albums? But there's probably another 7 albums worth of, like, B-sides and outtakes and rarities and stuff, you know?
But I was just wondering, and you might not know this, but are, like, there any songs from those 500 that nobody who did this program picked for their compilation?
Here's your answer, Sean. Get ready for this. So for years and years and years, I was mad at myself for not – I mean, they only did it for a little while because I'm pretty sure it lost a lot of money. And I was mad at myself for years and years and years. And then in 2010, after the bar exam, I was feeling good after the bar exam. Like, no one knows if they passed the bar exam or not. But, you know, you feel pretty good. Like, everybody screws up the bar exam a little bit. But the key with the bar exam, if you're screwing up, recognize you're screwing up. And there's tactics you could do to muddle your way through to survive. And everybody screws up on the bar exam. The people that do the worst on the bar exam and fail are people that don't realize they're screwing up. So I came out of the bar exam. I felt good. I didn't know I passed, but I was feeling good. And everyone's like, yeah, let's go party. Woo. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And it's 4 p.m. And they're like, yeah, 9 o'clock down at the place where we all used to meet up called the Bronco. And I'm like, well, damn, I got like 5 hours. And one thing I never understood is like between people like hanging out and going out to have fun, what are they doing for those 4 or 5 hours? Like, I never knew what people were doing ever. You know, Adam, do you know what people were doing like at the end of classes, but before partying? Like, I was only watching Star Trek: The Next Generation because I had nothing else to do.
I mean, if you were, if you lived with me, you were probably watching MASH. But I don't know. This has actually become like a big thing in our lives as we become older people. And like, well, we're not going out to party after class anymore. But like, when you go to a wedding and they have like the reception is in the or the wedding is in the afternoon and the reception's in the evening, and you have like 3 or 4 hours, and like, what do you do?
Right.
And I mean, so what happens in that case is that you find someone's hotel room and get drunk. But yeah, I don't know.
So I never knew what to do. So I said, well, I'm feeling good. You know, I've been working all summer for the bar exam. I'm feeling good. I'm going to do my favorite thing. I'm going to go to the record store. I went down to Rasputin Records in Campbell, California, and I'm flipping through the Beastie Boys rack. And sure enough, there's someone's custom mix of Beastie Boys Sound and Size sitting there for $6. I couldn't believe it. It was literally one of the best I ever had. I grabbed it. I'm like, holy crap. This has got like almost all the exclusive tracks, right? I couldn't believe it. I've been looking for that at that point. I've been looking for about 10 years. And I found on the day after the bar, on the day of the bar exam, well, the third day of the bar exam, I was so happy. I was so happy. And they also had the Japanese version of Beastie Boys' Hello Nasty with the exclusive Slow and Low live track. Then I go down the street to Streetlight Records. They had another exclusive compilation. Now, I'm pretty sure it was the same guy that had them both. And I think he went to two different stores to like maximize his money. And so I got two of the different custom mixes. And between the two, I had every single exclusive track from that Super Rarities compilation. I had them all. But since then, every 5 or 6 years, I come across one and I buy it. And I bought one for $20 off Discogs like a couple of weeks ago. But it didn't have anything new on it. It was just another custom mix. So the question is, I've got all the songs on the custom mixes. I have every single Beastie Boys officially released track. Well, not every single one, but almost every single one, right? But I keep buying these custom mixes when I see them for $20 or $25. Adam, do I have a problem?
No, I would buy them when you find them. This is now a thing that you have to collect.
I'm up to five of them.
Every single one that has ever been made.
Honestly, they're really, really cool. And it's got, if you're a Beastie Boys fan, it is the white whale, because there are so many like rare tracks that no one's even talked about before. I know there's the deluxe reissues of the albums. There are tracks on these compilations that aren't even on the deluxe reissues, that aren't even on any CD B-sides. And cool stuff, mind you, too. So they're just really cool. So if you're a Beastie Boys fan, stay on the lookout for them. And often stores mislabel them because they look at the front and they think it's just like a promo version of Sounds of Science, or just like a crappy version of Sounds of Science. It's actually a very rare and potentially worth more money version. So keep on the eye out for that. I shouldn't say that because I'm hurting myself, but that's how much I care about the listeners. Another thing that I got recently was this band, Zorn. I was at Philly Shreds Fest in Philadelphia. It's basically Philadelphia's hardcore punk fest. Not their hardcore fest, but their hardcore punk fest. And there's this band, Zorn. And I was getting kind of bored because there was like a lot of just generic DB bands. And this band, I was about to leave and everyone's like, you got to stay for Zorn. You got to stay for Zorn. I'm like, all right, I'll stay for Zorn. The band gets on stage. Half the band members are wearing like witches' hats. And then they start playing like kind of like this gothic music. And they bring this coffin on stage, right? And this guy pops out dressed like Dr. Frankenfurter. And he's whipping people with a chain. I mean, not really, but he's like, you know, kind of whipping them. And they just start doing this. It's hardcore punk, but it's kind of like goth hardcore punk. And I'm going to play a track later, I think. And Zorn in Philadelphia, it's just a far out band. And I think it's one of my new more. They're not there yet. They're not like a mind-blowing band yet, but I think they're on their way. And it's been a while since like a local band has really blown me away. And honestly, it's because I haven't gone to as many like super local shows lately. But this band was cool, and I dug it. Last thing that I got, let's see here. I guess I'll talk about I'm a huge Misfits fan, and years ago, actually, you guys know Misfits' 12 Hits from Hell?
Yeah. I think I'm familiar with it.
12 Hits from Hell is an unreleased Misfits album. What it is, it's a recording session that they took the guitars both of Bobby Steele and Doyle and laid them on top of each other, so it's technically the Misfits playing as a five-piece. And it was supposed to be released, but both Danzig and Jerry only pulled the plug at the last minute. So there were 5,000 copies, and they were supposed to be destroyed. And, of course, some of those got stolen. If you find – there's lots of bootlegs of those. But if you find an original, buy it because it's worth a fair amount of money, about $200. I don't have an original. I only have a bootleg. But actually, just today, I was coming back from a mediation, and I was feeling good. And I went to Double Decker Records, and they had a vinyl copy of 12 Hits from Hell. And, of course, it's a bootleg. But I bought it because it was reasonably priced. And I'm like, well, there's so many high-quality Misfits bootlegs anymore that I'm kind of getting back into the bootleg game, which is dangerous. Interestingly, though, Glenn Danzig famously hates bootlegs. But interestingly, he won't repress early Misfits records or anything. And so I don't know if it's because he's lazy, if he doesn't want to live in the past, or as a collector himself, he believes it's important to keep rare things rare, and either you have it or you don't, and that's why he's not repressing them.
Or he just doesn't want anybody to hear those songs, I guess.
Well, that might be it too, honestly. You know, I don't know. So here's the question. Is it cool to collect bootlegs when the artist themselves has actively hated bootlegs and gone out of the way to block bootlegs, even when the material itself is clearly excellent material that should get an official release?
Oh, yeah. I would say collect something if it exists in the world, right? I mean,
really?
The artist is, of course, perfectly within their rights to disavow these things and to not want them or not like them or anything like that. But like if something is out there, then I would say you are fully within your rights to consume it. I think that you just have to. Where you have to be savvy is that you have to maybe make a decision if it's something that is exploitative of the artist in particular, right? So if the artist has, I don't know, like I don't even know what the example is of this, but like if there's material that they don't want out there, there's material that they're going to release elsewise in a way that can help make them money, then yeah, of course it'd be a dick way to go like acquire one of those things, you know,
I'll give you the perfect example, Adam. Yeah. Southern Records is a great record label out in England. They do a lot of the crass stuff. They put out some beautiful, beautiful, beautiful editions of rudimentary P&I reissues. They were fairly expensive, $35, because they were amazing editions. A crappy Italian company, before like Southern Records announced them, said they're going to be out in 3 months. This bad Italian label, they did rush bootlegs at half the price that were so shitty and crappy, but the punks, P-U-N-X, bought those instead of the nice ones because they were half price, and it completely ruined the reissue series of Rudimentary Peanut. They only got halfway through because they lost so much money.
Yeah, so you don't want to participate in something like that that's going to be like, you know, really, it's going to get in the way of like, of the person that's actually has the rights to that work and is trying to put it out. But where I'm looking at it is that like, if you're at a record show and you're digging through a bin and you pull out some random ass Clash record that you've never seen, that's clearly not an officially sanctioned Clash record, buy it, because it's just some weird curiosity then that you get to hold on to. I don't think you're not like saving the estate of Joe Strummer, you know, a dime by not buying that thing. So I think that like it depends on the artist. It depends on, you know, the circumstance in which you're finding this stuff. I mean, I'd be a lot less sympathetic if, you know, you went onto the internet and found some, you know, Russian record label that was pressing, you know, bootleg copies of pop records. Like, okay, you probably don't want to go buy those. But if it's something that strikes you as strange and curious and interesting for the fact that it is a bootleg, then I'd be inclined to actually to get it.
I just don't know why Danzig doesn't release this stuff, man. It's easy money, it's quality material, and everybody would love it. It's a win-win-win situation.
So get on the horn with Danzig.
Actually, I'll talk about you guys off podcast. I've got a crazy idea that probably won't work, but I might try to do. But we'll talk about that later.
Let's dial him up right now.
Let's play a song.
I wish we had a way in Skype to make like phone touch tone noise happen. I'd use it all the time. Actually, we probably shouldn't have it.
Fair enough.
You play a song. I'm going to find a way to be obnoxious. One sec.
Okay. I'm going to, let's see here. Give me one second. I'm going to do this. Oh, never mind. I was trying to make a touch tone dial noise. Anyways, I'm going to play a song by Zorn. This is off Zorn's brand new record. It's basically their first EP. They've got a rare cassette, but I think this is kind of like their first official release. This is Zorn from Philly doing Hellblazer / Galactic Queen. And we're back. And it's already 10:20 and we haven't even started the episode. Wow. Stafford Sean, you're a happening guy. You guys got a lot going on this week. One of the main things that happened this week at Stafford Sean is that you are part of a release called Album Minus Jeff. That's part of a Jeff Rosenstock tribute record that's got covers of Jeff Rosenstock, Bound Music Industry, Arrogant Sons of Bitches, and Antigo Vespucci. You're part of it. And it got released today. And not only that, Jeff Rosenstock, in a true class act maneuver, said, wow, this is really cool. This really moves me that people are covering my music from 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and even this year. He was really thrilled. And I think he was honored that you all did that. Sean, tell us a little bit about this comp, the idea behind it, how it came together. And is it doing what you hope it does?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, you know, obviously I'm biased here, but I think it's a really cool project, that not just because I love all of Jeff Rosenstock's work, but also because of the story behind the album and kind of how it came to be, because it really was kind of a, it was kind of just an idea that somebody had on the internet and manifested itself completely out of people who were, who volunteered to do it, who are passionate about the music. This kind of all originated in a Facebook group, which at the time was called Jeff Rosenstock Post Posting. It keeps changing names, so, you know, it'll probably be different by the time this episode comes out. But anyways, it just kind of started as a post in that group, and anybody who was interested in contributing to it was accepted to the group. And that means that anybody who was inclined to contribute to this, their song got accepted. There really kind of wasn't any barrier to entry, and that kind of ended up in there being a really kind of mixed bag. There's 46 songs total on this album. There's a lot of material here, and I'll admit, like, it's a bit hit or miss. It can be a bit daunting if you're not like a huge fan to dig into it, but there's like really quite a few gems on here, especially like, coming back to that telethon cover, of It Shits, I'm So Gross. That was incredible. The cover of USA, which kind of descends into this improvisational free jazz little session at the end. There's just so many creative things, and there's so many just very weird things that you wouldn't get like on a tribute compilation that manifested itself in a different way, particularly stuff like the cover of Sorry Brooklyn, Dancing Won't Solve Anything, just kind of gets in, just very insane at the end. And I thought that was really cool. Another thing that like I really appreciated about this album was how much of a community and collaborative effort this was. My band, Brian C. Stars, covered one song in particular, but there were three other songs that like I did like just kind of backing vocals, or there's one song that I did like the vocals for the entire thing just because people needed help with different aspects. I contributed the cover art. The name of the album was voted on by people in the group. Like, everything was a group effort. There wasn't really a clear-cut leader. It was just whoever wanted to step in for this could make themselves as involved as they were willing to be. So there's just so many kind of cool tidbits about the album. And I'm really happy with how it turned out and happy that Jeff likes it. So
did Jeff's validation make a significant difference in your mind about the release to you, or was that just kind of like icing on the cake that didn't really mean too much? That is, I guess the question is, were you doing this for you, or were you doing it for Jeff, or both, if that makes any sense?
It was kind of out of just kind of a want for it to exist, I guess. It's all people who,
I mean, that's a
wanted to pay tribute to his music, I would say.
It's an interesting thing to have to contend with, I think, if you're in Jeff's position, because, I mean, on the one hand, it's probably incredibly flattering and you should just, you know, graciously accept that. On the other hand, to take it and to share it too much could seem like it's self-aggrandizing, which is probably not something that he wants to do. So it's I mean, it's funny because like Chris Farren leapt right into it, right? And Chris is all about like mock self-aggrandizing himself online anyways. So he went and shared it and he's like, I co-wrote two of these songs, so really it's a tribute to me or something like that.
That was hilarious. You know, Chris Farren's freaking hilarious.
Yeah,
man.
I recently saw him live. But interestingly, and this is a bit of a peek behind the scenes, we were actually trying to get this onto quote unquote records. And someone emailed Jeff and he was like flattered by the idea. So he knew about this beforehand, just slightly beforehand. But he was like, I do feel a bit weird about putting it out on my own label because it does feel a bit like, look at me or whatever, but like he was still supportive of the fact that it was going to exist. He just wasn't going to kind of put it out himself and kind of be drawing attention to himself. So I feel like that was kind of right on the nose.
So what would you have done if he was like, I hate this, this is stupid? Like, what would you have done?
I'm not sure if he has listened to it. I think he probably, like, it seems like he's just, he would mostly be flat. This is me reading into it, 'cause I don't know where his situation is on it, but by the time he was tweeting it, the thing he tweeted was like something about, like, he just got back and saw that it existed. So I think it was more, he was commenting on its existence, not on the actual content of the album. But
so what, now that this is out, right, what happens to this community that made it?
Well, they break up and honestly they hate each other now, they go away.
There has been talk of a part two. A lot of people are very, like, kind of excited about that, and a lot of people who weren't involved are like, have been saying like, oh, I'm bummed I missed out on this, and like wanting to contribute. So that's like, that's in the works, that's kind of being talked about right now. That group is still active, mostly like kind of sharing like links of like response that people have had to it. But right now, then, and there's also a it's kind of, it's inspired a different tribute that I won't say too much in that vein, that's not to Jeff Rosenstock, but this it's kind of spawning other projects at this point.
Is there at all a splinter movement within the community?
What do you mean particularly?
Well, I've been involved with like a handful of like open source software communities that have existed for a long time, and of course, like with Punk News and all these various like things that only sort of exist because the members of the group have decided to make it happen with no regard to their own personal financial well-being. Mm-hmm. And inevitably, when you have those kind of things, like over time, certain people emerge as leaders just because of their personalities, and certain people are going to start to clash, and certain people are going to get on each other's nerves. And then, you know, a group of like-minded people think that they're going to be able to do this better or worse over here. And just naturally, those amorphous volunteer communities start to morph and fracture and go in weird directions and who knows what. So, at some point they could all start to battle, right?
Yeah, there weren't too many like straight up like clashes. There were some kind of, you know, people had to kind of take leader roles in order for it to get done. Like deadlines had to be set, and then those deadlines were then extended and then extended again. But there was kind of some of that. There weren't really many people at each other's throats because I think everybody just kind of understood that everybody else's project was kind of their own and they could do whatever they want with it. And again, I'm like, there's a lot of stuff on here. And as I said, some of it's kind of like hit or miss. I think like for the most part though, it's definitely like a good thing that people were able to do whatever they want with it. And I'm happy that at least from my perspective, I haven't seen anybody else who's really been all that negative towards particular covers or towards particular groups. Though I guess the reverse has kind of become true, where different people have kind of found artists that they really enjoyed through this whole program.
It's like, 10,000 years in the future, you're going to have like the Red Jeffs and the Black Jeffs, and they're just gonna do battle over like the nuclear hellscape that is America. It'll be great. Wasn't there like, there was a fucking South Park episode that did that? It'll just be like that.
That's a parody. I'm almost sure it's a parody of something else from like the 70s. I think
it happens, man.
It does. Listen, speaking of parodies, Stafford Sean is mocking the universe. No, I'm sorry, Stafford Sean is mocking Live Nation and the Big Bucks Festival, and he's throwing his own DIY festival. His own band is playing their last show. Breakneck is playing their last show. And who's headlining?
Right now, Heart to Gold is, but also Telethon, a band that I've talked about twice already on this show. and the Eradicator. I like
that. Well, that's Charles. Tell us about this festival. Why are you throwing this festival, and where it's at, and what's the deal, man?
Well, I mean, we kind of came. I mean, I kind of came up with the idea of just like kind of wanting to showcase a bunch of bands that were local and that we had played with and had become good friends with, and be able to showcase that in like a 1 day festival. And I started kind of conceptualizing this around last September. And then, about like a month later, me and the other person in this band, it was kind of just a two piece at that time, kind of started to realize like we're kind of done with this band at this point, and decided to kind of rope this whole festival into that and make it like this kind of big event that would be like our last show. So it's just mainly people that like I know personally or just like are local around the scene, other than Heart to Gold, which is a band from Minnesota. And Telethon is technically located in Milwaukee, though the members live all over. A couple of them in Chicago, one of them also in Minnesota.
Well, what's the date? Where it's at, and how can people get tickets? Or yeah. Is it just a show up at the door and pay the bucks? How's it?
Yeah. Work? It's July 14th. It's at Evolution Music in Downers Grove, which is a Chicago suburb. And there aren't like tickets that you can buy beforehand, because just we couldn't figure that out logistically or whatever. But if you want, we have just like kind of a Facebook page, and you can kind of RSVP on that. And if you want to just reach out and make sure that you're, we're gonna have like a kind of list similar to Will Call, so that people who know that they want to come, we won't get to max capacity before they come. So there are people kind of asking about tickets beforehand. I don't know if we'll reach max capacity, but in case we do, you can get on that list if you're sure that you are going to make it. But yeah, I'm very excited for this. And
dude, Adam White, how impressive is Stan Frashawn? He's putting out albums. He's breaking up a band, starting a second band, and he's throwing a festival before college. How insane is that, Adam? How insane is that?
I did an enormous amount of dishes before the show, John. I didn't finish them, but I did many of them, and I'm not getting any fucking credit for doing these dishes, but let's all praise Sean.
Adam, we're all very proud of you for being an excellent father, for contributing your little but valuable free time to Pung News, for being a good husband by watching the dishes and taking care of the children, and being
I've brought life into the world, John. I've created life that basically makes me a god, and Sean's putting out, Sean's being in bands and doing drugs and things, whatever. I'm incredibly jealous of Sean's whole existence. And that's why we need to keep him around here. So we need to like siphon his youth energy.
We do. We're like vampires. We do. Sean, how impressive is Adam that not only does he have two children, not only is he a happily married man, not only does he run a successful and like 40 under 40 computer business or something like that, but he also uses his free time to give back to the kids and talk about punk rock once a week on the internet. How impressive, how wonderful, and how inspiring.
Where's my tribute
that
album?
Is much, much more impressive than me just asking a bunch of people that I know if they want to play at a certain place on a certain day. Like, this is just a one day thing. That is a life commitment.
Yeah, that's right.
So Adam, I'll record a tribute album for you. Adam, you want one?
No, please, because I know you will, and that is the point where our professional relationship becomes creepy. So don't do that.
You remember the time I made fake album covers for Joe Pallone and like actually pissed him off?
No.
I made five album
although,
covers.
John, I have to say, I mean, as far as I mean, I realized today that I have a Discogs artist page exists for me that lists my contributions to various musical records that are all things that you've created and is all under a name, an artist name that you came up with for me. And I don't know how much more of my personal brand I concede to you.
People love that. People, I when I tell people about our hip hop names, people say Dynamite Adam White is like the best hip hop name ever. It is pretty good. Dynamite Adam White. It's got a James Brown reference. It rhymes. It's like almost symmetrical. It's pretty cool, Adam.
I hope so, because I didn't choose it.
Well, listen, speaking of festivals, while we're fawning upon Sean, let us give him an ominous warning. Because, Sean, this could be you in 7 years, if you're not careful. Montebello Rockfest, one of the larger rockfests in Canada, and certainly one of the larger ones in Quebec, and maybe even the biggest one in Quebec, is filing for bankruptcy. This is a great shock to a lot of people, because Montebello Rockfest has a lot of big bands play. One year they had, like, Danzig and the Misfits, Jello and the Dead Kennedys, except for Jello dropped out. We're talking big, big rock, and not just punk bands, like big, big rock bands. They're filing for Canadian bankruptcy, which I don't know how that works compared to American bankruptcy, but basically they're $5 million in debt, which seemed like a lot to people, but for a giant corporation, being $5 million in debt is not that bad. But maybe it is for like a music festival, because you have no real assets aside from the name, I guess. Apparently they owe about 100 creditors. It wasn't clear if the bands weren't paid or other vendors. Montebello Rockfest hopes to continue forward, so they're doing some type of reorganization. I don't know what they call that in Canada. What can be haunting to staffer Sean is Montebello Rockfest. The guy that runs it is only about 25 now. He started the festival when he was like 22. Like, I'm amazed this guy started like big rock fest when he was like 22. Like, we're talking $1 million rock fest when he's like 22. I don't know how he did it, and it was successful for at least 5 or 6 years. One of the criticisms of Montebello Rockfest is they would do, I guess what I would say, maybe not everybody, but personally I would say, is kind of shady stuff. Like, they would do Operation Ivy and then in tiny letters next to it, tribute set. Or they do, like, you know, Black Flag and then the tiny letters next to it, tribute set. And they would also do, like, Danzig on one day and the Misfits on the next day. And I don't know if that's shady or clever marketing, because it suggests a reunion when everyone knows a reunion is not going to happen. So a lot of questions here. Is Montebello Rockfest failing because of its shady activities? Is it a guy that just bit off more than he can handle? Or are there just too many Rockfests anymore and many without identity? Because even though Montebello Rockfest is a gigantic festival, I don't know that it has an identity, to tell you the truth, aside from rock.
It is a strange animal of a thing. I mean, it is probably like the biggest rock music festival in Canada, let alone Quebec.
And this guy's 25, Adam. That's insane.
Yeah, the kid was like 17, I think, when he started it, right? But it has been so... And I say this as not having been someone that's attended, so forgive me if I'm stepping on anyone's good time here. But like, for something that is so massive, it suffers from, I guess, like, it suffers from its own from the expectations of drawing those crowds, because its lineups always read to me as incredibly generic, to the point where it doesn't necessarily seem like it would be the time, like the thing that I would want to attend, right? Because you look at any of their posters, and yeah, it does that kind of shady thing that you mentioned, right? Where they play a little bit fast and loose with the hope that some people that aren't going to pay all that much attention to the fine print, you know, go don't focus in on that, because the one thing that like Rockfest I think has going for it is that like they capitalize on how generic it is, right? It's not trying at all to be cool, and in not trying to be cool, it plays to no particular scene. They just play to like things that they know will draw in people, right? So if you were to compare it to, God, like I'm trying to think like any other like independent music festival in Canada, like they're not in the same ballpark. And it's not just because like Rockfest is so much bigger. It just like lineup wise, there's no shame in it, right? So you look at, I'm looking at, this is the 2018 one, right? So it's bands that they know will draw. you know, Prophets of Rage, Prophets of Rage, Weezer,
Daffy Duck, Prophets of Wage, Prophets
you know,
of Wage.
But that, you know, this is up at the top. So on the one hand, you might say it's a punk rock festival because it says, okay, Rancid, Dropkick Murphys, you know, Lagwagon. But then you look and you say, like, it's all right, Flogging Molly, Millencolin, Sum 41. Like, these are all bands that at one time were big bands. And individually, if they toured, they would draw well, I think, in a show. Like, if you went and you toured, you know, if you brought Flogging Molly out to Toronto, a lot of people are going to go to that show because in the 2000s, they were, you know, they liked Flogging Molly in high school. Like, that was a moderately popular band, right? But they're not touring too much these days. And I think a lot of the people that come out to that show aren't necessarily tuned into whatever the band's new material or anything like that is. But they sort of exist on one of those, like, name recognition levels. But at the same point in the Rockfest lineup, I guess in the same font category up there, right? You've got Lamb of God, A Day to Remember, Five Finger Death Punch, and then you've also got Stone Temple Pilots and Godsmack and Tenacious D and Jimmy Eat World and all this, right? And what it ends up being is it ends up being, you know, moderately big bands from sort of like any rock and roll genre that you could, you know, that would you know fill a big concert hall in a major city, right? And it's, you know, it's not all punk, it's not all metal, it's not all hard rock. It's sort of like the big things plucked from each of those scenes. And I feel like in our universe, a lot of the snobby, you know, Canadian indie music people that I would, associate myself with these days, there are bands on this bill that they would want to go see, but, you know, they'd probably look at this and go like, you know what, I'm not going to go stand in a big muddy field with, you know, a bazillion people who are there to see Stone Temple Pilots and Godsmack so that I can see
Toy Dolls.
Yeah, so that I can see Toy Dolls, or that I can see, I don't know, like, who's lower on the list here that you could see, like,
I don't know, I'm having trouble finding anybody that's, like, honestly really good. Let's see here.
But it's like, or I mean, like, Propaganda's that, but those are still big bands. But, like, so, okay, here you go. So there's a band that's, like, really low on the list here called Moody, right? M-U-D-I-E, which is the band that, which is sort of like the synth pop slash punk band that what's his first name,
is that Hugo?
Yeah Hugo Moody from the St. Catharines and from Pooza and stuff like that, right? And that's a cool little band, but they're and they could totally go and show up and play, you know, they could play any indie music festival in Canada and people would go there and be into them. But here, they're just like, you know, if you were a fan of that band, you're not necessarily going to go to this if you don't want to stand in a crowd full of people there to see, like, Steel Panther and, like, Dimmu Borgir or anything, right? Like, it's just an
excellent pronunciation of Dimmu Borgir. Wow.
Right? Like, it's a crazy-ass lineup because it's just stuff that is big. And what I think, like, the Venn diagram of this festival is super interesting for that reason, because I think they're really drawing on name recognition from a lot of people that aren't regular concert goers otherwise, but see this as sort of like their once a year big, like, let's go camping and go to a crazy rock and roll show. And, like, anecdotally, that's even what it seems like. There's, you know, some of my wife's cousins who I've haven't seen out to very many shows ever in like the local area that we're in. Like, they don't go see bands around here, or at least they don't go see the same ones I do, but I never hear them speak about music as something that they're engaging with, you know, day to day. But they'll definitely, I'll see one of them pop up on on the internet and be like, who's coming to Rockfest this year? Like, it very much draws, I think, people that, you know, that see this as their big thing. Like, they've, you know, they're not in high school anymore. They've moved on with their lives. They, you know, they have other things that they do. But you know what? They want to go fucking rock out to. I love this lineup. It's crazy. Like, you know, they want to go see the Mighty Mighty Boss Stones and Cannibal Corpse, right? Well, this is where you could do both those things, right? And so it's strange, and it seems so generic from that. Even the name, like, it's called Rockfest. Its logo is a guitar, right? Like,
it's sponsored by the most generic of all beers, Budweiser.
It's sponsored by Budweiser. It's like, it's not too much of anything. Like, if you were a serious fucking metal fan, it would probably disgust you to be around a lot of these bands. If you're a really serious punk, then a lot of the stuff here that you're going to like reflexively hate. I don't know what scene you'd have to be from to be like a major Stone Temple Pilots fan, but maybe that's the point, is that like, you're from no scene. Like, it's name recognition, and it's, hey, like, it's Rockfest. It says on the label what it is. You want to go rock? We're going to go to Rockfest. Right. So it's always occupied this strange space where I don't pay much attention to it, even though it's the biggest thing. And there's been people that have written us in before on the podcast here and been like, you guys are crazy why Punk News doesn't talk about this more, given how massive it is. And, you know, like, valid criticism, because like, we've ignored it for a long time. I think just because it didn't have that hook for us. And the fact that the lineup is so varied with big artists, it makes it hard to see that it's something that we need to address, right? Like, you kind of, it's very much in the style of a big European festival in that way, because a lot of those big European festivals, like Grozrock, is that how you pronounce it? Grozrock? I don't know. Like
I care about Vakken.
Yeah, so a lot of those big festivals that are in Germany and things like that have similar kind of lineups, where it's a lot of big names from a whole bunch of different scenes and different subgenres of rock and roll, I guess, that they bring in. And part of bringing that in is that you have enough of those big names on the label, and you know you're going to draw enough people who are fans of each of those individual bands to all of a sudden have 20,000 people in a field. So, you know, I'm kind of averse to being in a field of 20,000 people in most circumstances, so it's never been something I've been like tempted to go do. But yeah, I mean, that's what Rockfest is. It is like a big, massive, generic thing that, like, to its benefit, isn't trying to be cool.
I just want to say, like, I feel like every single year this lineup comes out, and I always think, like, if I was in the area, I would totally go to this. Like, it's got a lot of big headliners diluting the kind of lineup, but I honestly, there's just so much going on at the same time. Like, I feel like that typically doesn't matter for me. So maybe I'm the outlier here, but I every year just find so much that I would love to see it at Rockfest if I was in the area.
No, and I mean, I definitely don't want to criticize, like, anyone that goes to this, or even, like, the people that put it on. Like, they've, I mean, outside of the fact that they have no money, they apparently found something that worked, right?
They found something that worked, except for it doesn't work at all, but, you know.
Yeah, okay, let's say they found something that worked. Maybe they didn't financially navigate it properly in recent years, but up until recently, it seemed like they found something that worked. I should probably just go to this so I could understand it. But like, I have such a hard time understanding, like, the mix and the logistics of this, because there are so many bands that are on this. I have a hard time even physically understanding where would they all be? Like, And I have these horrible visions of, like, Woodstock 99. Right,
Cypress Hill, Rollins Band.
But Rockfest leans into that. Like, go to their website right now, and like, the background image is, you know,
just a sea of
60,000 people in a field. And if you scroll around and look at a lot of the art and stuff that goes with it, you know, it's crowd surfing. It's like pictures of rock girls shaking their tits. It's, you know, drunk dudes lying around in a field because they're so burned out from rock festing all day. It's really, you know, it's really embracing this sort of like rock and roll is a sleazy good time thing that I feel that like a lot of like the indie music scene, you know, has tried to like, you know, I either become too PC for or too self-aware for. Like you never see Fest, you know, go share, you know, a bunch of pictures of like of, you know, good looking women in skimpy clothing.
I disagree, Adam. I think they do that all the time. They just do it on the sly. They're like, check out the Fest pool party, and it's a bunch of good looking girls. Like, so I think Fest is actually being kind of sneaky that they are doing that, but under the guise that they're not doing that.
Sure, but under the guise that they're not is the thing. There's no guise with Rockfest. It's like, hey, it's Rockfest. We got Rancid and we got tits. Come on, right? So, I don't know. I'm too much of a dork or a coward to admit that that's what I want. So,
you ladies need to put some clothes on. You might get sunburned. Stafford Sean, is this an ominous warning to you? Are you having second thoughts about Sean Fest?
Oh, I'm one step ahead of Rockfest in that I do not plan to make any money beforehand. So,
I thought you said I've already got my bankruptcy paperwork filled out.
So yeah.
I like how you talked about Canadian bankruptcy, like it's like Canadian bacon, like it's like a totally different thing that doesn't work in the same way.
It might be. I mean, how does bankruptcy work in Canada, Adam? I have no idea, honestly.
I neither do I, and I hope not to.
It's like, did he file for bankruptcy? Worse, he filed for Canadian bankruptcy. Oh God, not Canadian bankruptcy. Anything but Canadian bankruptcy.
All right, so what are we doing?
Somebody play a song about Canadian bankruptcy, or just
I got one. Okay, all so right. this is a band from Vancouver called Dumb. They just had a record they put out on Mint Records. Their entire record is a quasi concept album that is all in one way or another about money, about making money, about not having money, about interacting with money. And the song I'm going to play is called Mint, which, as everybody knows, is a, you know, slang term for money. It's also the name of the record label. And Dumb is great. Dumb is kind of like a slacker punk band. Their lyrics are kind of snide and dismissive in a great way. And they're super fun. So here you go. This is the song Mint by Dumb off their record, which is called, Seeing Green. Money. And it's on Mint Records. There you go. This is Dumb.
Swap a death and clean up bread.
that was dumb doing. Min, let's blast through some ska news as we do every week, talking about ska. There's a big documentary coming out that people are very excited about. It's about 90s ska, and it basically it's kind of like the American hardcore of 90s ska, and then it follows Real Big Fish, No Doubt, 311, all those ska bands and how they came to be. It starts off by tracing the history from the Jamaican scene to the two-tone scene and to the contemporary scene, and I think it's called Pick It Up. Isn't that what it's called?
It's called Pick It Up.
It's called Pick It Up, and it's got a lot of interviews with a lot of different third wave ska people. A lot of people are excited about this. Adam, what you were a third wave – actually, stand for Sean. What's your stance on third wave ska? Are you excited for this, or is that before your time?
No, some of my favorite bands are third wave ska bands. I mean, we talked about Bottom Music Industry before, Suicide Machines, Streetlight. All some of my favorites.
Do you consider Bomb a ska band? I don't consider Bomb a ska band.
I'm split. Like, I mean, they're – album minus band is definitely a ska record, even though it's got some cuts that aren't ska at all. Like, it's mostly just ska songs, and then they kind of sprinkle them in throughout the rest of their discography. But I'd say it depends on the record. They have ska records.
Adam White, all right. As a ska fan, where does this ring on your register? Unnecessary or the thing you needed the most but didn't know it?
I'd watch the shit out of this. I mean, I'm really curious to see how it's phrased and contextualized, because like ska at the time was seen as so goofy and uncool and dumb, but at the same point it was blowing up, and at the same point everyone like universally disowned it all at around the same time. So like I'm curious what the retrospect is on that, like whether they go the route of being a little bit serious about it, or if they just treat it like the kind of goofy thing that it was. I gotta just pick fights with both of you here. 311 is not mentioned in the list of bands involved in here. And I hope they're not involved in here, because that's not a ska band, right? There is definitely a crossover. A lot of men that wore the same bucket hats and cargo shorts at ska shows would have went to 311 shows, but
men, it's always men.
And then Bomb is interesting to me too, because I remember when like Bomb was not part of the third wave scene in my head.
What about Arrogant?
I mean,
yeah,
Sons of
Sean.
Bitches. Yeah. You could make an argument that like Arrogant Sons of Bitches was like on the tail of it, but Bomb, I think, I remember a lot of people when Bomb first came out were arguing that like Bomb is the fourth wave, right? That, you know, everything died, but here's finally a band that's like coming out and using those component parts from third wave ska to make something interesting, but it's not. So, you know, we've kissed Jeff Rosenstock's ass enough right now, so I'm gonna leave them out of this. But yeah, the ones that I'd really be interested to see them follow here, I mean, more than anyone, would be Skank and Pickle.
Mike Park, Skank and Pickle.
Mike Park's man, because Skank and Pickle in my mind was so instrumental to what I got to know and understand as ska, and Asian Man having grown out of Skank and Pickle was so important. I mean, they put out that first Lesson Jake record. They were so, like, they were so so credible, right? Like at a point when the majors were coming in and signing up all these bands, like all these bands are being signed to fucking imprint labels that didn't mean anything, and pushed into the world by majors. So, you know, Real Big Fish and Goldfinger and bands like the Pilfers were like they were signed to Mojo. And Mojo was not, as far as I can tell, like a real thing. It was an imprint that Universal came up with that they used for those records. And it was something you were supposed to see. Like Mojo was supposed to be a mark of quality for third wave ska. Like, you know, they're really trying to build something there. But I'd be surprised if there was ever more than two human beings that were Mojo, and it was just, you know, it was just Universal trying to make a buck. But Asian Man. You know, Asian Man was Mike, and Asian Man was out there doing this before and after it was cool from the rest of the world. So like from an artistic standpoint, like that's the one that I kind of want to see, is like what's you know, what's Mike got to say about it?
Skank and Pickle isn't technically Asian Man, though, Adam White. Hmm.
Sure, but Asian Man grew Skank out of the Pickle career.
Is still the proto Asian Man record label.
You know what I mean, John.
But Mike Park is going to be interviewed.
Adam White, Operation is Operation Ivy, is that third wave ska or is that proto third wave ska? 2.5 wave ska.
I would argue that Op Ivy is an in between. But I would also argue that like Op Ivy in my head was more of a punk band.
Agree. And speaking of Op Ivy, the Op Ivy influence band, the Interrupters, have released a new track. What's very interesting about the Interrupters is for years and years and years, a couple of years of punk news, they got a lot of skepticism from the punk news readers. Then with the release of their single, She's Kerosene, it all turned around and now everybody's a fan of the Interrupters at punk news. They released a new track. It's called Gave You Everything, and it's probably the last single they're going to release before the album comes out this Friday. The album will be out by the time you hear this program. I've got some thoughts on, well, I'll just say my thoughts is, I don't know if I'm being contrarian or not. When everybody hated the Interrupters, I'm like, they're not that bad. They're, you know, she's a good singer. They're a pretty good band, not great. And now that everyone thinks they're great, I'm like, eh, maybe the Interrupters are a little overrated. I did think She's Kerosene was a fantastic song, but I just wish it didn't have such a heavy mark of Tim Armstrong. I mean, it sounds like Tim Armstrong. Like, I wish they had their own identity. I thought this song, Gave You Everything, was kind of a bland, generic pop song that could have been sung by any pop star or any generic rock star and didn't move me at all. It almost felt like it was cliche built on top of cliche. That's not to say I hate the Interrupters. I like the Interrupters. I think Amy Interrupter is a great singer. I just don't know how to place this band in my mind. On one hand, I want to be like, they don't deserve all the hate. They're pretty good. They're sticking it out. But on the other hand, I'm like, well, they are kind of just doing everything by the numbers. And is that interesting?
Yeah, I'm exactly pretty much what you said. So I don't have much of an interesting take on this, I guess.
This song, which interestingly in our ska discussion is not a ska song, right? It's just it's a rock song. But like this song is like it is sung in Tim Armstrong's cadence.
Right. Isn't it almost eerie how Tim Armstrong-ish it is?
And I don't know what to make of that because I'm not sure. Like, of course, the Interrupters are giant Rancid fans. Of course, Tim has been involved in their career. But like, I don't want to sound insulting, but like, it sounds like Tim's working as a vocal coach here. Like,
well,
like,
he is. He's producing it, you know.
Well, right, but like she went in and she maybe Amy went out and sang it like her way, and then he was like came in and he's like, no, you sing it my way, and then he like, you know, I was about to go into a Tim Armstrong impression there, and I didn't.
I like how your Tim Armstrong has like a slight Brooklyn accent.
Yeah, because that's
no, sing it my way.
Yeah,
is he slightly Brooklyn?
No, but my impression.
Didn't he live in New York for a while?
Slightly stupid.
Didn't you live in New York for a while?
Did Tim Armstrong? I'm sure Tim Armstrong has like.
I think he's dead.
Existed
in LA now.
In New York for a long time. I don't think he ever lived in New York. I mean, he was always like an East Bay guy, but
Lawrence, there was a time.
There was a time when he was so involved with, you know, with the scene that was going around between, he was involved a lot with like the Stubborn Records bands. We talk about Scott,
Slackers, King Django.
Yeah. King Django, like Skinnerbox, Stubborn All-Stars and stuff like that. Like
Dave Hilliard.
Yeah. So he was so involved with all those guys. I'm pretty sure that he, at the very least, spent a significant amount of time couch surfing in New York, but I don't know if enough to give you a fucking accent. In any case, he doesn't have an accent. That was my dumb impression.
It doesn't really have a NorCal accent either, though. He's got the Tim Armstrong accent.
Yeah, he sounds like he crawled out of a pit in a field. And anyways. But, like, it sounds like he went out and, like, sang this song. And then, like, having sung this song, like, encouraged Amy to go in and, like, sing it as if it was coming out of his mouth. And I don't know what to make of it.
What was even more interesting is that She's Kerosene, which I thought was a great song. Did you agree, Adam?
Yeah, that one was fun.
That song is sung from a male it's not sung from a female's perspective because there's our lyrics in there where it's clearly a male singing, which I think is that interesting or is that tacky? in that, is that interesting that it's a female simply singing a male's parts just for artistic interest? Or is it just laziness that they didn't even bother to change the lyrics? You know what I mean?
I guess, like, what I'm unsure of is that, like, I'm not sure if the Rancid influence is supposed to be something that we're latching on to, or is it supposed to be something that we don't notice? Because, like, that could be one of the selling points of this, is that, like, hey, if you like Rancid, you'll like the Interrupters because they are doing, like, a world-class Rancid right now.
The only, like, the only thing is honestly, like, She's Kerosene is better than any Rancid song from the past, like, 15 years.
That's why I said world class, right? Like they're doing Rancid better than Rancid right now, but, like, to a T. And maybe that's a selling point on it. But on the other hand, like, I don't know, like, I'm too familiar with Rancid that that's not a selling point for me. Like, it's distracting.
Yeah, well, it's like, I love Bauhaus. And then anytime I hear a band that's trying to sound like Bauhaus, I'm like, they're trying to sound like Bauhaus, and they're not as good as Bauhaus. The kicker here is Interrupters are better than Rancid at this point.
I mean, this, I had a conversation with someone the other day about this, where I have a friend that runs a label, and they put out a record that was a goth record by a band that really fucking sounds like The Cure. Like, the singer sounds so much like Robert Smith that it... That like, it's in the exact same category here, where you look at it and you go, like wow, like they are devotees, right? Like shamelessly. And I liked that record, that goth record. Like, it's, there's a lot of cool songs that are on it.
And Adam, I don't really, you think Cure is goth? You think Cure is goth?
I mean, like, I would say, like, Disintegration Cure might be goth. I mean, like, there's a lot of, like, new wavy Cure, but that's not the... But in any case, though, like, this was a record that was clearly, like... I saw the press that they are doing for it, and a lot of the press that was going out, when they were releasing new songs, the new songs they were releasing were on websites that I'd never heard about, but clearly were, like the punk newses of the goth scene. Of the, like, the, like, there are post-punk and goth websites that kind of do what Punk News does, but, like, to that scene, right? And I'm looking at it and going to myself, like, all right, like, in the same way that, like, you know, I can go listen to a band like The Interrupters, even if they sound like Rancid, and say that, like, you know what, that's just sort of like, that's the style in which they are playing. It's like they're playing a Rancid-style punk song. I can kind of get how this other band was playing, like, they're playing, like, in that Cure style, like, taking The Cure as a genre and playing within that, right? And I didn't mind it for that reason, because that's how I read it. But, like, there were music critics that were in that had picked up that record when they released it that just savaged it for that reason. We're like, this sounds like the fucking Cure. Like, it sounds like a ripoff of The Cure. And I'm like, that feels overly harsh, because of course the band knew that, so it was intentional, right? And I think that The Interrupters is sort of the same way, like, that they sound so much like Rancid, I don't think is news to them. Like, they're of course massive Rancid fans, and it's of course obvious to them where the Rancid stylistic quirks show through in their songs. And clearly they're releasing songs they want to release because, you know, they're not being forced to be in The Interrupters. So
are they? Maybe we should,
are they? Right,
we
see, yeah.
Blink twice if you want to get out of the situation, you know? Right.
But like clearly they know that, and their fans must know that. So I don't know if it's something I should be worrying about for the same reason. Like everybody in the room knows that The Interrupters are, you know, Rancid as a genre. Is what they're doing, in the same way that everyone in the room knew that this other band was like Cure as a genre. And I think if you approach it as with your, like, generic music critic hat on, and you approach it where you're like, you know, I'm a citizen of the world and I take in all kinds of music and judge them, well, then you're going to be really harsh, because you're going to be like, yeah, I heard this when it was Rancid, right? ... Which I heard when it was The Clash. Fuck off, right? But in
... when I heard when it was Gene Vincent, fuck off. ... I heard when it was Little Richard, F off.
But I think that, like, to the in the scene that, like, The Interrupters is playing into, like, everyone's in on the joke, so it's not a big deal. Like, it's got to be that same kind of thing.
Well, speaking of things that might be big deals, and speaking of ska, members of the Up Up Ups and Posers, namely Tim from Up Up Ups and Johnny Mick from Posers, have formed a new ska band with Brittany Luna on vocals. The band is called Cat Bites. They've only released one song. It's a cover of a Specials track. I wouldn't say this track is mind-blowing genre-wise, but I would say this track, to me, sounded really, really, really good. I thought it sounded better than the Selector's version, and I think Brittany is an amazing singer. Like, I thought her voice was just stellar on this track, and I wanted to hear more. And I guess the other two did not listen to this track at all.
No, I was letting you carry that because I haven't heard the track
yet. I will say, though, the question is, I do very much like Posers. Thank you for turning me on to them, John. Yeah,
well, they're broken up, so. That's a band that really could have achieved a lot. But, you know, the other members are up to stuff, so maybe they'll do really, really cool stuff, you know. It is a shame that band broke up. But, I mean, sometimes when bands have some steam building, but they don't capitalize on it at the exact right time, they kind of burn up, you know, and I've seen that happen a lot of times before. And so that kind of happened with them, but, well, what can you do, you know? The members are up to stuff, and hopefully it'll be cool. With Cat Bite, I don't know if they have grand designs for this or they're just doing it for fun. The only track they've released so far is a cover. I thought what was very interesting about this is it was almost actually more rock steady than the Selector. The Selector is strictly two-tone, and this track actually added a little bit more soul to it. And I just think it sounded fantastic, so I'm definitely excited to check this out, and I might be interested in ska going forward. One last thing that will wrap it up, because we're running real late tonight. This is not on the ska tip. The Ramones. The Ramones is a band of four moms that are playing all Ramones covers. And on the Punk News website, this got tons of hate. However, in the greater world of the universe, this Punk News article was by far our biggest article of the month and one of our biggest articles of the year. It was so big that Legs McNeil talked about how he thought it was great. I would call it Marky Ramone talked about how he thought this was great. And not only that, our article led to this band getting 15 offers to play gigs. 15! The Ramones. And I think it's because of my title. I put all mom band to pay all Ramones covers. The Ramones. And I just think this is whimsical and hilarious. And also, actually, I want to point this out. I'm going to chastise the Punk News readers, which I've never done before. They were boo-hooing on this and hissing. And not really the commenters who don't represent the readers. But they were boo-hooing on this and hissing on this. If it was four boring bearded dudes doing all Ramones stuff, would they boo on it? Or would they just be like, oh, yeah, you know, the guy from Hot Water Music is doing all Ramones. That's great, you know. They think, oh, this is so great. But because it's four moms, middle-aged women, you find me a band of four middle-aged women. Now find me a band of four middle-aged women that are moms. Now find me a band of four middle-aged women that are moms that like punk rock. This is an interesting and amusing concept, and also it is a excellent step forward for equalization in genders in punk rock, and also equalization of ages in punk rock. And I think this is great, and I think this is wonderful. And I think we need more moms and more punk bands. That's what I think. So,
I think good for them. It's cool that they are getting out there and doing this. For me, honestly, it kind of comes off kind of like Max Sabbath or like that Ned Flanders band.
Max Sabbath's hilarious.
Yeah, but it feels just kind of, I don't know, like a bit of a gimmick. Like I would be all like. I want to say that if they are playing originals and I enjoy their stuff, like I would go out and support them. We've had conversations, or I'm not sure if I've been on any of the episodes where haven't you guys said that like cover bands that you're not all that into them? I'm not sure what the main difference is for the Ramones.
The main difference is that a cover band is stupid just because it's a cover band. This is four types of people who do not usually play rock and roll, who especially do not usually play punk rock, coming together. And not only are they coming together, they're coming together with an amusing twist for fun. So this is not four middle-aged dudes living their dreams that never happened to be the Rolling Stones. This is four moms recognizing that they're four moms and they're playing punk rock, and there's something inherently funny about that, or something reaffirming about that. And also, Sean, not everything needs to be Neutral Milk Hotel. It is okay to have fun in rock music. Just ask Montebello Rock Fest with Rancid and Tits. Good time.
I guess I'm not as amused by it, but good for them that they are getting like shows from this, and I think that it it's cool that we have that influence.
Adam, why is Sean such a hater? Why?
I was just surprised that this was so
young.
Big.
He's young. He's still rebelling against moms because he's so young.
Adam, you think this is funny and cool, right?
I do. I mean, I was a little bit curious at first because my initial impression, honestly, was to look at it and say, like, lots of people in bands are parents. Why is this a thing? But I think that there's some shtick here, and I'd actually want to see what they're doing with it. I'd like to actually see this and how they play that up and how they work that in, because if you're, you know, cynically, there's lots of bands that sound like the Ramones. There's lots of Ramones cover bands. There's lots of people in bands that are moms and don't make it kind of part of the identity of the band. But here, as it is part of the identity of the band, now I kind of want to see what's going on. Like, I like the idea, and the way that you phrased it was interesting to me. Like, I like the idea of it being not just a Ramones cover band, but more that, like, that these are people that would normally not be out there playing a rock show. Like, I from that standpoint, that's the hook.
Yeah, I feel like I kind of agree with Adam on that point. Like, I mean, like, I'm not, again, not against
you, this. He just reiterated what I said, Sean. But,
well, I just don't know how they're going to inject this into the identity of the band other than the name of the band.
Well, for example, Beat on the Brat, should they leave the lyrics originally, or should they make the lyrics more mom-centric?
If they make it more mom-centric, then I think it's got more appeal to it. It's unique. It's got that kind of character.
See, for me, that's too much. I just want to hear four moms. And I respectfully disagree with you on this point. I kind of just want to hear four moms blasting through the Ramones as hard and as vicious as they can. And another reason is you don't usually hear women doing Ramones covers. I mean, sometimes you do, but you don't usually see four women doing Ramones covers simply because the Ramones are a guy. So I think that's interesting, too. So I'm more interested in hearing four women blast through the Ramones because there's a gender difference rather than total shtick. Adam White, what's your take?
I think, like, I've really got to, like, decide which kind of mom we're talking about here, because if I think about this in the terms of, like, of my mother and her friends being a Ramones cover band, that's amazing to me, right? Like, I want to hear, like 60-year-old women doing that, because that plays into that whole part of the Ramones mythos where they're, you know, what they're doing is pretty simple and anyone can pick up a guitar and do this, right? Like, it plays into that. If I think too hard about it, I start to think about, like, well, hold on a sec. All of my friends who are women right now, who are, like, of my age, of my gender cohort, like, most of them are moms. And because we're young parents with kids, you know, all of our friends are parents right now. Is this sort of what happens? So I'm like, well, that doesn't seem all that interesting, because, like, I know and see moms all the time, and they don't seem, they're not something else. They're just, like, all my peers are now moms. So whatever. But if I think about it that way, less interesting. If I think about it from, like, you know, if I put myself into my, you know, I'm a little kid again, and it's like my mom has a Ramones cover band, that's amazing.
Again, I'm not hating on this. I just, you know, wouldn't. I'm not seeing as much. It doesn't amuse me as much as it seems to amuse you. But I'm not against this.
I think Sean just called me simple minded, Adam.
You said you were amused by it.
I heard the icing in your voice when you said, well, I'm not amused by it as much as you are. I heard that, John. I heard that.
That was not intentional, but sure.
John, I think that really the tribute record that you want to write is, you want to write a tribute record for Sean, but it's a, you know, it's a little bit of a tribute slash beef record. Then you can just take him down.
But who, honestly, Adam, who could hate on Stan for Sean? Throwing festivals, recording tribute albums. We can't beef with him just because he's got it going on, Adam.
He does. Let's all just keep kissing Sean's ass. All right, so what are we doing? Are you playing a song, John, or is Sean playing a song? Or what's
I already played one. You played one, Sean. Play one of the songs, jerk.
Play us out of here, actually. If anyone wants to email us, it's podcast@punknews.org. We're going to cap it off with this.
I was going to do a transition from the Rosenstock comp to this, but I forgot to at the time. But there's a relation here in that the lead singer of Telethon, Kevin Tully, I initially just roped him into this like as soon as I found out that it was happening and let him know that this Rosenstock compilation was happening. And he was like super down with it, and obviously they did their cover, and it's great. But through this whole compilation, he found a band called Barely March, and I also listened to their cover. It didn't stand out to me all that much, but he absolutely loved it and dug into their discography. And now Halloween Records, which is the Telethon label, and also Brave View, which is Alex's other band, they're putting out Barely March's debut album. And while that cover didn't really, you know, stick out to me at the time, I absolutely love the stuff that he's putting out on his debut album. Kind of these mathy sparkle punk riffs and stuff that kind of like the emo revival was built around, except with a twist in that it's kind of all like drum machines and it's super glitchy and stuff and very unique, it has a lot of character to it. So I'm gonna play the single off of Barely March's debut album, which is called Merrily Barch, and this song is called Thinking Emoji.
This has been a Valor Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@valorundergroundstudios.com.